The reading that I'd like to share with you this morning is in two parts. It's a story that I want to tell you, and then I'm going to try to play you a little piece of an On Being episode. On Being is one of these public radio shows that I tell you about all the time. I used to be able to listen to it as I was driving in on Sunday mornings. And during that phase, they were always talking about exactly what I was planning to talk about when I arrived here. And they changed the time, so I've lost my synchronicity for Sunday mornings. But it's an interview program in which she, Krista Tippett, who runs the program, interviews an extremely wide array of spiritual leaders. Her definition of what a spiritual leader is very broad, which is part of why the synchronicity with Unitarian Universalists Sunday morning happened all the time. So this particular interview that I want to share with you in two pieces is an interview that she did with Amichai Lau-Lavi, who is a rabbi in New York City. He's really only been a rabbi for a year and some, although he's comes from 37 generations of rabbis. I had to calculate that. It's over 1,000 years. Well over 1,000 years. That's a lot of rabbis to have looking over your shoulder. Well, I'll tell you some more about his story in a little bit. But so she interviewed him, and he's doing some pretty experimental stuff. And he's started a Jewish community, and this is their purpose statement or mission statement. Welcome to Lab Shul, which is lab means a place to experiment, and shul is sort of a, I think he's meaning it in a whole bunch of ways, for religious community and temple and learning place. An artist-driven, everybody-friendly, God-optional, pop-up experimental community for sacred Jewish gatherings based in New York City and reaching the world. I'm just going to read that again because it's delightful. Welcome to Lab Shul, an artist-driven, everybody-friendly, God-optional, pop-up. Pop-up means they don't have a building. They just go, they find places to do their thing because you don't want to own a building in New York City. Pop-up experimental community for sacred Jewish gatherings based in New York City and reaching the world. So he really has been an artist for a lot of his life. And so he really thinks about this from the lens of being an artist. And especially a storyteller. So in the interview, he tells just a little story that he says he's been grappling with since November. And he calls it a Talmudic parable. And it's a story about a ship, and the ship is full of people. They all have their cabins, and it's sailing along. And a person who has a cabin on the lowest floor of the ship decides to dig a hole in the floor of their cabin. And water starts to come into the cabin. And the other passengers scramble around to try to figure out what's going on and figure out that someone has dug a hole in the floor of their cabin. And they say, "What are you doing?" And he says, "Well, it's my cabin. I paid for it. I can do what I want." Needless to say, the whole ship goes down. So the rabbi goes on to say that this is a story that talks about human responsibility in the Jewish sense, that we're all on the same ship together. And he's been wrestling with, he says, where have we been focusing only on my cabin and me, 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 me. And where are we not part of a we? How is that true of every single one of us? And how is that true in some ways of America? And how the narcissistic, me-focused, insight-driven, my own needs and aspirations in this age have taken so a hold of public and communal responsible for the other that we have forgotten to be responsible for everyone, including the limping and the weak at the edges of our camp. The Bible reminds us again and again to remember, you remember the other. Remember the other. You were the other. So now I want to play you just 2 minutes of this interview. Well, hopefully this my sound check worked. Because I want you to get to hear his voice. Just going to disappear behind the candle bowl for a moment here. And he's going to come in talking about love. So you'll hear his voice, and then you'll hear Krista Tippett, who's the interviewer, and then they have a little exchange. And he comes right in with a question about love.
And I'm trying to think, how do we use love? How do we go face-to-face in difficult conversations with those who see the world so differently than some of us and whose values are coming from the good place of me and preservation and even have a we in mind, but it's not as expansive and radical as the we that I'm thinking of and some of us are. How do we use love? I'm sure that that's... I'm sure it's keeping you up at night.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I
know
think,
it's keeping me up at night.
Yeah, and it is something we have to walk this, right? Because there aren't answers to that question you're posing. I mean, I was thinking also at the very beginning when you talked about a new sense of God being born after the Holocaust, the kindness. I mean, I think love is also, it sounds so grand, and it sounds like it's something you have to feel. And this love we have to practice now and learn to practice is so much more practical than that. And
mm-hmm. Yeah. It's daily. It's mm-hmm. daily practice. It's ironic to me now. I'm in my late 40s and I'm a father and I'm a rabbi and I'm looking at my life and how it's evolving and who knows what else. And I sit every morning for a few moments wrapped up in my father's prayer shawl. I meditate and write in my journal. I rarely use any of the liturgical texts. And what it's about is discipline. It's just daily discipline. It's a workout. And it's the workout for gratitude. And it's a workout for, you know, what Heschel called radical amazement and wonder.
Yeah.
And it's just an exercise in meditation and silence. Sit for a few moments and cultivate love. And I'm so amazed that at this point, this tool that I inherited that's in my toolbox is right there.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I don't drink tomato juice and I don't read the paper, but I kind of do what my father did. I carve this little space each day for being in the me so I can be there more for the we. And I am now really conscious of how at core it is an exercise in love. So that I can be there more agile and helpful when more contentious moments happen the moment I turn on my phone or open my front door.
How do we use love? I'm sure that's what's keeping you up at night. I know it's keeping me up at night. I love that the rabbi just assumed that the interviewer was also up at night wondering about how do we use love, wondering how love can shape the world that we're in right now, how love can enter into this dilemma that we live in the middle of every moment and shift it. That he's up at night, and I think thinks that a lot of people are wondering how we get love to show up in the hardest places and in the most public places. And so, of course, he's wrestling with that story about the boat sinking. It's a that story captures my mind partially because of the absurdity of someone digging a hole in the bottom of a boat. But also the way that that lets us see the absurdity of a certain kind of action in the world. And a kind of action that we encounter daily. An unwillingness to see the connections between one's own life and other people's lives. And the problem of people making choices that are just purely destructive in the name of, I can do what I want. Certainly see it in the news, our government's response to Puerto Rico, the fact that the Health and Human Services director has had to resign because he charged so many trips on private jets. It's all that way of being in the world. So it sounds like an absurd parable, but in fact, it's in the news daily, hourly. But the thing that Amichai Lau-Lavie is thinking about is not that most blatant public version that in some way we don't have an immediate ability to change. I'm going to point out, I used the word immediate. I think we do have the ability to change it. And this is how he's really interested in investigating how that way of thinking has crept into our lives, into our own minds and our own assumptions about what's normal in the world and what we'll just accept. And that if we can find those places and shift them, that it begins to change what happens out there in the public versions. So I got thinking about where are the places that the most extreme version has found its way into our thinking. And so I went and wrestled with the philosophy of Ayn Rand a little bit. How many of you have read? Yeah. I love the faces that just got made. I did not go back and read The Fountainhead. I did find an interview with Ayn Rand and Phil Donahue, which delighted me in the same way that the boat interview or story delighted me, just that happened. So Ayn Rand, I'm going to make some broad sweeps here, which if there are philosophy teachers in the room, you may wish to correct me at some future moment. But Ayn Rand went to this sort of hyper-rationalism, as if everything could be done in this some sort of logical form, that there was a sort of a fixed objective reality that you just had to interact with in this very rational way. Which I think daily life indicates that's not real. There, I've just dismissed her in four sentences. but that's sort of where she went, and I think her life experience led her to that. But I think it's actually a dynamic that we wrestle with daily, And Unitarian Universalism has a strain of this. And we don't say that it comes from Ayn Rand by any means. But there is a piece that used to be quite strong in Unitarian Universalism, that if it wasn't rational and objectively provable, then it was to be dismissed and sort of dismissed with an emotional tone of that's not good enough, which is sort of how she goes about her philosophy as well, which is one of the ways that, you know, there's a mismatch. So that's one of the things that I noticed, is that intense, pure, rational is something that Unitarian Universalists have had to wrestle with in the 20th century. And I think we're still recovering from that a little bit, allowing that expansive complexity, that everybody welcome God optional, artist driven pop up kind of reality, in which some people follow the scientific method and some people are mystics, and there's a wonderful meeting of those two things. I am a little biased in what I'm about to say. This congregation is particularly good at, I think, that meeting, a very comfortable meeting of the different ways of perceiving the world. But our tradition, in the larger sweep, struggles a little bit with this vein of hyper-rational humanists who think that that's the only way to be. So that's one of the things that I noticed is that tension in our world. But the other thing that Ayn Rand does, and this may be the thing that you know about her, is that she basically makes a strong argument that it's morally right to be selfish. That to pretend that you're ever being selfless or altruistic or acting on someone else's behalf is morally wrong and self-destructive, and that you shouldn't ever do it. So I thought about that, and I read some short pieces by her in which she was using as one of her arguments for why that makes sense, that the Nazis and the Soviet communists asked their citizens to be selflessly devoted to their regimes, and that that was clearly not good. And so the obvious solution was to be selfish, to not give up your self. In one interview that I watched, she said, "Nobody has ever given a reason why we should be our brother's keeper." Again, I think that it's fairly easy to give a long list. We could probably create an extensive list in the next 5 minutes. I'll let you do that in your minds. Why does that bother me? And I realized, I think that her problem is that she was experiencing a real problem. I mean, if you've experienced Nazism and Soviet communism fairly directly, you know that you need to not operate that way. And she took their public rhetoric at face value and accepted that they were saying you had to be selflessly devoted to this, and that that's where the problem was. But I think what actually she was experiencing was a government and a culture that was trying to dominate people, that was their primary interest, was to basically plow over people, make people tools for their own selfish objective ends, and eliminate people's individuality and people's ability to choose, and eliminate people as anything but just energy to one selfish end. And so she's actually resisting being steamrolled, but she didn't really identify that as the problem, and so she solved a different problem than what was actually happening. Why am I going on and on about this? I think that that same dynamic is being wrestled with in the world internationally right now. That what gets said is one thing, and that what's actually happening is something else. And so the need to drop down into a different level of awareness makes a difference in how we can engage. And that it's actually very easy to get hooked into the explicit public rhetoric that's out there. It certainly draws one's attention. And so the work, I think, is to keep finding a way to pull our attention down to the deeper levels of life. And so I think the thing that she missed is that the cultures of domination were trying to eliminate people's agency, meaning their own ability to choose and make decisions. And that's where the power is. And that means a completely different way of engaging with each other. It means that creation of everybody welcome, God optional, meaning your particular answers to things are not the place where we're going to conflict. What we have to figure out is how we're going to be together, not which exact conclusion someone has come to. And I think that that's one of the answers to the question about how do we use love, that we keep dropping down into the reality of there are forces that are trying to completely dominate our lives, and we have to keep engaging our ability to choose what happens. And so we have to keep defining a way of being together that's different. And we have to keep doing it not only every morning as the prayer practice that you heard described in that clip, but every hour, which you have noticed is exhausting. But I think that's how important it is right now, that those forces of domination are working so hard on our lives that it's easy to get sort of give up our choosing all the time. So I want to tell you just a little bit more about Amichai Lau-Lévi. Not only is he 37th generation rabbi in his family, but they were all Orthodox, which means its own set of this is the right answer, this is how you have to be, there things that are so forbidden that we're not even going to talk about them, including if you happen to be something like gay, which put this young man, and Amichai Lau-Lévi, in his early adolescence in a real bind, because he realized that he was gay and 37th generation Orthodox Jew, and that those two things were completely incompatible. He was also coming of age in 1980s New York City, where the subject of sexuality was very alive and available, and a conversation that could be had out in the world, just not in his family life. So he had to figure out how to use love in this scenario in which one part of his world told him he couldn't even talk about who he was. And another part of his world who thought, Orthodox, ooh. So he stepped away from Judaism for a while and became a drag character named Hadassah Gross, who was, the character was the wife of a rabbi, Orthodox rabbi. So he left Orthodox Judaism to do drag about Orthodox Judaism. Which is a really complicated way to navigate a set of stories and experiences, to stay engaged, to love. If you watch some of his drag, he clearly loves his Jewish tradition. He's totally embodies it, of course. At the same time that he's turned it into a character who's very funny. It's a fantastically complicated situation that he puts himself in. And it's his way of staying present for his spiritual life and of loving his tradition that won't have him. He eventually found his way back to participating more directly in Judaism and has become a rabbi in a non-Orthodox branch of Judaism. And he describes his calling as being to tend to the people at the edges and the fringes, which is, of course, something that other religious leaders have been called to do. In fact, there was another rabbi, I think, even further back than 37 generations. What's 2,000 years would be, what, 45, 50 generations? It's a common calling for spiritual leaders to try to keep using love to pull us together in ways that are uncomfortable. And that one of the other little bits that Krista Tippett says is we have to walk this because there aren't answers to the question that you're posing. There aren't answers to how do we use love, except, I think she means, by just living every day, every hour, figuring out how do I use love in this situation. How do I stay awake and choosing and connected in this moment over and over again? In the lab shul, they celebrated Rosh Hashanah a week ago, 10 days ago, and it happens that the Jewish New Year and the Muslim New Year were on the same day, which doesn't happen very often. And so they celebrated together. He pulled people in from the Muslim community, and they had a big dinner cooked by Syrian refugees. They found a way to pull people together who aren't usually celebrating together. And we have to keep looking for those places, both big like that, big public. I think they had 1,000 people at this celebration of the Jewish and Muslim New Year together. And also those small private moments. Those moments when we make that space for the me so that we can be there more for the we. I think when we think about love as action in the world, we tend to think about those big public presentations or connections. And I appreciate that he keeps coming back to those moments for the self so that we can keep showing up. There's a piece here that I will have to put into writing for you because of linear time, with which I have an ongoingly conflicted relationship. So I'll just tell you that this week I'll send you a letter about a conversation I got to have yesterday with Susan Frederick Gray, who is the new president of the UUA. She's our first elected female president. I'm on the Northern New England District Board, and we got to have a conversation with her yesterday, and she said some interesting things about how our tradition, I think, is stepping into these ways of having love be an action in the world. But the one piece I want to tell you now is that we talked to her about staff and Black Lives UU and her public witness, and at the end when she thanked our group and talked about how important Unitarian Universalism is in the world right now, she was in tears. When she had talked about all this content and really been that competent public presentation self, and then she was in tears with us about how important being a Unitarian Universalist in the world right now is and sharing the work with us. And I was really stunned that our leader, a newly elected leader, was willing not only to have the conversation, but be in tears about figuring out how to live into these questions, how to figure it out together. And so I hope that we can have a conversation over pancakes about how we'll find new ways to use love to make ourselves a little uncomfortable because we're reaching to the edges and making a more and more embracing we.